good horse, I call you.
I eventually came to understand that the oil of Iraq was the great prize of World War I, seldom said in your history books.
Take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're listening to episode 684 of Unwelcome Guests, The Supranational Deep State. I'm Robin Upton. Our title is by Peter Dale Scott, from an essay which I shall read for you in the second hour. And for the first part of the show, we're going to hear Charlotte Dennett, from whom we heard a snippet just now to let you know where her talk is going. The theme of this episode is the false bottoms of deep politics, how lies are used to hide other lies. When you think you've uncovered the truth, in fact, perhaps there's just another lie underneath it. Case in point, the 1953 CIA operation to change the leadership in Iran. Or was it a CIA operation? Our first speaker, Charlotte Dennett, says quite clearly, no, it wasn't the CIA that organized that. They got on board, provided some degree of legitimacy, okay, that's a relative term, but actually it was organized and conceived by the group that Peter Dale Scott refers to as the Wall Street Overworld. Now, thanks to Active Ingredients for the following talk, which Charlotte Dennett gave on the 23rd of September, 2010.
Vermont lawyer, investigative journalist, and author with special interest in the roles of big oil pipelines and the U.S. corporate policy in the Middle East, Charlotte Dennett gave a talk titled Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, and the strategy behind U.S. interventions. This interest was related to her father's death while working for the Office of Strategic Services in the Middle East and Africa.
I feel like my grandmother is looking down on this and applauding. I just say that because the Middle East was very important to her, and the Middle East was very important to her son, my father. And there are three of us in my family, but I'm the youngest, seem to be the one that's carried the torch and am trying to do the best that I can to inform Americans about our foreign policy and what it's all about. The reason that I began this quest was because as a young woman, it was in the 1970s, and some books had just come out on the CIA, and this was the age of Woodward and Bernstein, and I was a young woman who was thinking about making a career out of investigative journalism, and so we were learning about this organization called the CIA that many of us didn't know a whole lot about. I remember Agee's book, Inside the Company, it was called, and there were a couple other books. And I had just met my future husband, and at one point I said to him, you know, my father was in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor of the CIA. And I said to him, there's some papers up in the attic. There's some notebooks up there and scrapbooks. And I think I'd like to go back and start reading them. And there had been times as a girl growing up when I would occasionally go into those scrapbooks. And one of the things that I always looked at was the announcement of his death in the Winchester Star, where he grew up, Winchester, Massachusetts. And you know, sometimes you'll see something and you'll get something out of it, and then you go back to it and you get more out of it. So by the time I was a young woman in my 20s, I went back to it yet again after having a conversation with my husband. And I realized that there were some problems with the official story as it appeared in the Winchester Star. Among other things, it says that my father and five others who died in a plane crash in Ethiopia on March 20th, 1947, that he was on a vacation junket. And my mother, the one thing my mother always told me, it was really the only thing I knew, and that is I knew he was a spy. I didn't know anything more about it. I knew that his cover was U.S. cultural attaché for the State Department, but that's all I knew. And my mother didn't talk a lot about that work. So it started to become important for me to understand what was behind his plane crash. And that has begun a saga that's gone on for decades. Many visits into the National Archives. I haven't totally solved the mystery, but as I predicted, in the course of doing the research, I learned a lot that most people are not aware of, and that's what I want to share with you tonight. This is not going in the order of my discovery. First of all, just want to let you know that I did find the accident report in the National Archives, and there are pictures of the plane crash. Fortunately, no picture of the bodies, but certainly the wrecked airplane. These are Ethiopian villages that are carrying the bodies on mule back to the local town. And I went through the whole accident report and found that there were some serious questions. And if you want to ask me about it later, I'll be happy to do, but it just heightened my interest. One of the things I wanted to understand is Ethiopia. What was he doing there? He was based in Beirut, which is here on the eastern Mediterranean. And he had just come from a top secret mission to Saudi Arabia. Now, how do I know that? Because I have his last letter home to my mother, and I have his last official report to the State Department. Somehow, somebody sent it to my mother. So when I compared the last letter home and that last report, this is what I knew. He was on a mission to try to determine the route of the Trans-Arabian pipeline that was going to carry oil from the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, and somehow it was going to have a terminal point as yet undetermined on the eastern Mediterranean. If you look at the eastern Mediterranean now on this map, you will see that it is bordered by Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, and a little stretch of Turkey. And if you come away with any insight from tonight, it should be this. You cannot look at any single state in the Middle East without seeing how it relates to the whole. Okay? So keep that in mind. For instance, this whole area right here, you will find books. One of them is a real classic by George Antonius. It's called The Arab Awakening. He talks about the rectangle. And the rectangle, as I said, goes like this. All right. What's inside that rectangle? Iraq and part of Saudi Arabia and part of Syria and Jordan and Lebanon. When I was in Lebanon later, I went. My mother took the children home after my father died. I was 6 weeks old, but I ended up going back to high school there, 63 to 65. And when I was there, they always call Lebanon the gateway to the Middle East, right? But they left off a couple of words, because if you're an oil man and you're looking at this region, what you're looking at is gateway to Middle East oil, all right? And another thing to take away from this evening is as follows. It's one thing to find the oil. It's another thing to ship it to market. So therefore, if you are an oil man, person, whatever, you're always trying to think what is the safest, most economical way to ship oil to market. And in those days, and right up till now, one of the major ways is pipelines. Okay, so what about Ethiopia? It's way down here. So after his trip to, in trying to figure out the route of the pipeline, there was a sudden change of plans, and he boards a plane with five other Americans that had come from Cairo, and he goes down to Ethiopia. Now, one of the things I found in the accident report, I knew the petroleum attaché was on board because that's in the obituary in that article. But I would later find out that there were a couple of interesting things. One is that an aerial camera was found on board. And another thing is there was a book called, believe it or not, was found by the wreckage. It's called This Fascinating Oil Business. So I figured oil has got to be part of the story. And I will tell you that much later, as I did more and more investigation, I found out that during the 1930s, there had been a U.S. geophysical survey of the entire region in sort of a crescent like this. It was a whole circle that encompassed Africa, East Africa, all the way over to the Middle East. and there was a lot of oil in that whole area. So when you start hearing about disputes in Africa now, you hear about the Horn of Africa, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, a lot of problems going on right there. Don't kid yourself. Oil is part of the problem. Okay. But as I say, I'm compressing years of research into a very short period of time. One of the first things that I did to try to figure it out was I looked in the New York Times. What was going on just the first 2 weeks before my father's death? And lo and behold, what do I find? March 2, 1947, this major article which says, Pipeline for U.S. adds to Middle East issues. And it talks about the position of Russia. There's obviously deep concern about who's going to control the oil. And I'm sorry, this is a bad reproduction. The pipeline that I was focusing on, the Trans-Arabian pipeline. And again, I came back to the map later, and I said, wait a minute. I see two other pipelines. There's this one, and it seems to branch in two. This area is, guess where? Iraq. Okay? Keep that in mind. It's very important. In any event, so I read this article, and one of the points that it makes is that protecting the investment and the military and economic, security that it represents inevitably will become one of the prime objectives of American foreign policy in this area. So I'm thinking, oh, man, this was big. And there was, as I read through the article more, I could see that all the major powers were focused on this pipeline. There was this feeling that because the Americans had gotten control of Saudi oil, it was going to change the whole balance of power in the region. Before then, it was mostly the British who had controlled the oil. Now the Americans were moving in a big way. And I would later discover that when my father was sent over there, he had been trained as a spy, and I've gotten access to his papers from the National Archives, and one of his first reports is that he thought he'd been sent there to spy on the Germans, but by the time he got there in the fall of 1944, the Germans had essentially left. They had been defeated. And the primary groups that he was spying on, number one, the British. You know, we're still in war, right? He's spying on the British and the French and the Russians. And meanwhile, he's trying to keep track of all the different ethnic groups in the region. And I have come to conclude that my father's job was to make the Eastern Mediterranean safe for the Trans-Arabian pipeline. That was his job. And that has relevance to today with Iraq and Afghanistan, which I will get to. Well, let me just come back to this pipeline here that branched off from Iraq. I eventually started doing research into that pipeline. When was it built? It was built in the 1930s. And who controlled it? Well, the English controlled the southernmost part, and the French controlled the northern part. And this was a division that had occurred after World War I. The French and the British had divvied up the whole area. And you may have heard these words of the British mandate and the French mandate. They just created a mandate system and said, the French said, we'll control the upper part and the British will control the lower part. And that way we will secure not only the safety of this pipeline, but we will make sure that, you know, the money goes to us. I mean, they couldn't agree on sharing it. That's why they had to split it in two. And that gives you another idea of the kind of rivalry that was going on by all the big powers who on the surface are allies and in reality are engaged in what I call the great game for oil, a very bitter struggle. It's not a game, actually. It can get very, very bloody and brutal. At some point, my husband kept urging me to go back even farther in time. After all, even though that Iraq pipeline was built in the 30s, when was it conceived? And what I came to learn is it was conceived before World War I. And I eventually came to understand that the oil of Iraq was the great prize of World War I, seldom said in your history books. I don't, who here in this audience came to understand that the oil of Iraq was the great prize of World War I. How many people read that in their history book? Nobody. Way, what do you know? What do you know? Yeah. So then it suddenly hit me, okay, well, before World War I, what was the situation? This is the beauty of history. You know, when you're solving a puzzle, you have to keep going back in time to try to figure out when something began. So what do I run into but plunk right into the Ottoman Empire, of course, because it was Turkey that controlled all this area before World War I and then was broken up, defeated. You may remember that it was the Turks and the Germans that were allies during World War I, and it was crushing both of them that the Allies were able to get that oil. But having realized that Turkey was the hub of the Ottoman Empire, I'm thinking, wait a minute. My grandmother was teaching biology in Turkey sometime around the turn of the century, and that's all I knew about my grandmother. She had taught in a school in biology, so that required me to go back in time. And one of the places I went to was Smith College, because she was a graduate of Smith. I didn't even know for sure when she graduated. The only memory, really, that I had of my grandmother was this painting. It was actually done by her sister, Aunt Helen, which is a square in Istanbul, then known as Constantinople. That now sits in my living room as sort of a reminder of the family legacy. But beyond that, I knew very little. So one of the things I did is I contacted Smith, and I found out that my grandmother had gone, she graduated in 1897. She majored in biology. Then she went on to MIT and got a more advanced degree. And next thing you know, she gets shipped over to a place called the American College for Girls. And here's a book actually about that place. And this is the story of the woman who ran it, who was a missionary. That got me thinking, was my grandmother a missionary? Why did she come to teach biology? And so here is what I found in the Smith yearbook. That's my grandmother, 1897. The Smith archivists were extremely helpful in trying to get me information. And this is what it says. Her name was Redfern. And it says, Elizabeth Goodwin Redfern's life is a constant struggle between a Puritan conscience and the desire to be wicked. Grandma, that's great. Wow. And what better place to resolve the conflict than in the land of the sultans? As it turns out, she was a missionary. She was sent to Turkey. She taught Armenian girls initially because they were Christians. The sultan did not want Christians proselytizing Muslim women at that time. And so she taught Armenian girls, and she befriended another woman, a British woman, who also taught there, who then scandalized the college, ran off with an Arab prince, married him, and got involved not only with the sultan's palace, but the harem. And so this was, like, outrageous for the American College of Girls, but my grandmother kept up the friendship over the years. And Princess Fatma, she adopted the name of the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. Princess Fatma later moved with her husband to Beirut and would be a great source of intelligence for my father when he went to visit in the 1930s. So that's how things happen sometimes. You will find that a lot of the people who are in the Foreign Service, certainly during the first half of the 20th century, come from missionary backgrounds. Many of them were raised in, for instance, in Lebanon, the U.S. Board of Foreign Missions. It turns out, I knew that my grandmother was a Congregationalist, and then I found out that it was really the Congregationalists that spearheaded a lot of the foreign missionary movements at the turn of the century. And Smith College also. There's some wonderful documents if you go into their archives, and you will find, you know, Smith was actually founded by missionaries, and the feeling was that if women were going to have any kind of employment after they graduated college, mission work was one way that they could go beyond the standard, you know, being housewives and so on. And many of them were sent to foreign countries. And that's, I think it's a combination of my grandmother being a Smith graduate and a Congregationalist that had her ending up going to Constantinople. So I'm going to now fast forward. She didn't leave a whole lot. I've been into the archives. I've read what she did. Here's the most important thing that I gleaned about my grandmother is she was there at a very important time when the Germans were moving in to the Middle East. So we're talking 1900 now. Okay, now I'm retracing the story and I'm going to start taking you back again. 1900, the Kaiser Wilhelm had made several visits to the Sultan, and what he had done is he cut a deal whereby the Germans would construct a railroad. It was called the Berlin to Baghdad Railroad. I discovered this in the library of Robert College, which is like the brother college to the American College for Girls, a big American institution in the Middle East, still there today. And I was looking through their library, and I saw this book that said the Berlin to Baghdad Railroad. I thought, whoa, that seems interesting. So I opened it up and found out the Germans were building this railroad, and it was going to go through Europe and then end up going through Turkey, through Iraq, all the way to Iran and the Persian Gulf. And the more I read about that, the more I realized that the British were freaked out about the Germans building this railroad, not only because it meant German penetration of the Middle East, but because the Sultan had offered oil concessions to either side of the railroad. And so, again, I'm truncating my talk, but what it meant is this was a major cause, believe it or not, of World War I. The British did not want the Germans to get a hold of that oil in Iran or in Iraq. They already knew there was oil in Iraq because it would literally bubble up to the surface. So with that story, I was off and running. Now I'm going to take you quickly back to these pipelines. Here's a better rendition of it. I got this out of the National Archives. So again, you can see this is the Iraq pipeline that's broken into two. This is the Trans-Arabian pipeline. By the way, you might be interested to know that the borders of Jordan follow the transit route of the pipeline. That's how the British had devised it. So, you have to understand that this part of the world has to be looked at in terms of pipelines if you're going to understand foreign policy. And when you're thinking about Iraq today, I'll jump ahead a little bit. You see this one? This terminates in Haifa, which is now Israel. Has a major refinery there. The refinery fed the Allied war effort during World War II. The refinery is still there. And don't kid yourself, this pipeline was closed in 1948 during the Israeli War of Independence. And it was never opened since then. But the fact of the matter is there are great plans on the books to build a new one following that same route. Because after all, Iraq has been conquered. It's ready for business. Got to ship the oil somehow, right? I hope I don't forget to come back to that. If I do, remind me, because it's very critical to our understanding why Saddam Hussein was overthrown. Part of it had to do with building this pipeline again. He was opposed to it. Now, I really got into World War II when I went to the archives, and that's when I found these old documents that make it very clear, abundantly clear, that oil was behind World War II, not just World War I. Here's a government document that says World War II is largely a war by and for oil. Petroleum is one of the most important weapons of modern military conflict. And the more I looked into that, the more I understood that to be absolutely true. It's something we're not taught in school. I often give talks to students. I say, why is oil important to us? And they'll come up with, you know, it runs our industry, it heats our homes, it fuels our cars. No one says it's the major fuel of the military. There's a reason, because the military doesn't want you to know that. But that's what it is. It is the major fuel. To this day, it is the major fuel of the military. And once you understand that, then you come to realize why the Great Game is probably hotter than it's ever been, because it's harder to get at the oil. Although I suspect there's more oil under capped wells than they would be willing to admit. But nonetheless, it is a finite resource. So if you look at this chart underneath here, this gives you an idea of what the U.S. concern was during World War II. Here's the Nazis. They are worried the Nazis were pushing east and the Eastern Offensive. And what were they worried about? Capturing the oil of Romania, capturing the oil of Russia. And then you have the North African campaign, you know, Rommel, that famous campaign. That was heading right towards the oil of the Middle East. And they were very concerned about it. So here it is in black and white. One of the reasons why the U.S. government was so upfront about it during World War II is because they had to rally the American people behind the notion that the government and the oil companies were going to be working very closely together for the national interests. So they had to sell it to us, the generation at that time, that this was an okay thing, because it was a war aim, and we had to come behind the oil companies and the government working hand in hand. There was a short time where Iraq came under the control of the Nazis, so they did this sort of projection of what this would mean for the Allied interests. And what I found interesting about this map is the legend, pipeline and oil. And you'll see here is that famous pipeline. It's called the Iraq Petroleum Pipeline that truncates and goes to Syria, now Lebanon, and Palestine, now Israel. And then if there were any doubt at all about the role of oil in World War II, I found this document, and I'll just read you a couple of lines out of it. Oil is ammunition. It is a secret behind the secret weapons in this war. From oil field to battlefield, petroleum serves on every front. Then I'll take you over to here. This new and complete type of warfare was made possible by petroleum, the liquid fuel that has given a new way of living to Americans, a better and more comfortable and easier way of living. With mankind, here's the part I love, with mankind still war-minded, it is inevitable that a product so important to living should be adapted to means for mutual extermination. And further down, it says, can't read it, it's too blurred out, but you get the point. This was the head of the Petroleum Institute that was testifying before Congress and saying how important war is, oil is to the war effort. All right, now we're going to fast forward to the current war in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. I remember after September 11th, I had this feeling that our world was going to change very quickly. I had just confronted a deadline. I was doing a Freedom of Information request with the CIA to get my father's paper. And I'll never forget going to the post office the day after September 11th. That was my deadline to file it. And I was thinking as I did my appeal, because they had been holding back records, and my thinking, I'm never going to get what I need now. It's all over. That was my thinking. And it has been increasingly difficult since then. But very shortly after September 11th, this is rare. This came out in our local newspaper, Burlington Free Press. War will be linked to control of oil. Seldom is this blatant. And you read the first paragraph, beyond American determination to hit back against the perpetrators of the September 11 attacks is the hidden stakes in the war against terrorism, which can be summed up in a single word, oil. War will be linked to the control of oil. That is the title of this newspaper clipping. The map of terrorist sanctuaries and targets in the Middle East and Central Asia is to an extraordinary degree a map of the world's principal energy sources in the 21st century. The defense of these energy resources, rather than a simple confrontation between Islam and the West, will be the primary flashpoint of global conflict for decades to come, say observers in the region. So that was in October 1st, 2001. All turned out to be true. So that got me to do more research into the Bush administration. I'm just going to show you a few things. This is a cartoon, but it kind of goes right to the heart of what he was thinking on the eve of his election. This was a campaign statement in October 2000 in which Bush says, "I want to build pipelines to move natural gas. I want to develop coal resources. It's an issue I know a lot about. I was a small oil person for a while." Anyone who knows the history of the Bush dynasty know that they were not small oil. They were very heavily involved in oil. That's why they went to Texas. I would recommend a book called Family of Secrets by Russ Baker. It tells a story about the Bush dynasty that would blow your mind. Here are some of the people that he put into his cabinet that have links to oil. Vice President Cheney, of course, we all know, was involved with Halliburton, which is a major oil supplier and contractor in the Middle East. In any event, the other person that's very interesting is Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor, later Secretary of State, very heavily involved in oil. Does everybody know what oil company she was on the board of? It was Chevron. And I don't know if you knew this, but an oil tanker had been named after her. It was called the Condoleezza Rice. And then when she became National Security Advisor, they had to sort of scratch off the name. It was a little bit too embarrassing. Now, Chevron was the outgrowth of Standard Oil of California. It was a Rockefeller oil company, and they were the ones that made the great find in Saudi Arabia. Everyone thinks about it's Bush that developed all these ties with the Saudis. Before Bush, it was the Rockefellers and their Chevron Standard Oil that really laid the groundwork. By the way, the Rockefellers were also heavy investors in the universities, the one where my grandmother taught. In fact, she helped get the financing for the American College for Girls. That's another story, but it ultimately ended up with Rockefeller financing. Rockefeller Foundation is a major funder of the American University of Beirut. And the way they look at it is these colleges were the second most important investment next to oil. Reason being, winning over hearts and minds. And they did a damn good job of it, I have to say. For a very long time, the Americans were loved, because rather than control the people of the Middle East, as the British had, through direct political control, colonial policies, the Americans use what's called indirect control. You would support local leaders, but you would also provide education and teaching, giving these people an education and also good medical care. The American University of Beirut has a fine medical college. That won over the goodwill of leaders in the Middle East for decades. Then it all started to go downhill. It started in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel. They still were able to keep fairly good relationship, but by probably the 70s, the relationship started to seriously deteriorate. And with it was the collapse of really good intelligence gathering, which is another story. That's one of our big problems, because today the spies out there, they don't have the knowledge of the customs, and that's gotten them into terrible trouble. Anyway, one of the things, we knew very little about what was going on initially under Bush, but we do know that Cheney's task force on energy had been meeting about the oil of Iraq, and we have still not been able to get the details of those meetings. But they did produce maps, and here's one of them. And I'll just read. You see these black blotchy areas? The guide below says that these are super great oil fields. All of this area, blocks, they haven't even been exploited yet. All right, so now you're beginning to realize this is high stakes, controlling this. And as you know, we now have the biggest embassy in all of, what, the Middle East? One of the largest American embassies in the world, right? Now you know why. Comes back to the song of the Raging Grannies, because it's also military bases becomes very important to them. All right, at the same time, of course, they were looking at Afghanistan. Now, this document, this came from 1997, and as you can see, unrest in Afghanistan is disrupting plans for pipeline. So another part of the plan under Bush was that this was a great opportunity to exploit the natural gas reserves of the Caspian Sea. They saw the Caspian Sea as like the next great Saudi Arabia. So there was a lot of maneuvering about how to control that. And the idea was to run a pipeline from the Caspian Sea that was going to feed the markets of India and Pakistan. And mind you, the Caspian Sea was viewed as this great new region because the Russians had been, the Soviet Union had been defeated, no longer controlled all those stands that existed in that area. So here is a map that I got out of the book on the Taliban by Rashid. The yellow lines are either constructed pipelines or proposed pipelines. And the one that we should be paying most careful attention to is the proposed pipeline that's going to run from Turkmenistan this way through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. And it has a name, TAPI, T-A-P-I, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, TAPI. Look it up. Google TAPI. And you'll learn all about it. One of the major reasons for shipping this natural gas was to fire up a utility in India. And guess what its name was? Enron. All right. The Enron plant. I still haven't figured that one out, okay? What did this whole Enron fiasco have to do with the Trans-Afghan Pipeline? That's for some of the Smith students to try to figure that one out. But I did find that very interesting. They're still trying to build this pipeline. Almost done. Yeah?
Where is that pipeline supposed to finish up in India?
It's supposed to be in India. I cannot tell you exactly in India, but it is in India, on the western coast of India. This came out in the New York Times. It's the pipeline, stupid. Oh, they're worried about pipeline attacks have undermined more than just the U.S. occupation in Iraq. This was recognized by Osama bin Laden in audio tape in which he talked about, he called on his followers to, quote, focus your operations on the oil, especially in Iraq and in the Gulf, as this would mean the West's death. So in any event, that's always been a concern, is sabotage of pipelines. That's what security is all about, and that's why they're building all these military bases.
What's the date of that?
This is, it came out about 5 years ago.
The beginning, 2004.
Yeah, it's around then.
Or sometime after that.
Story, one of the biggest stories of 2004 was peak oil. That's how it starts. So it's around then. This is a 2001 article, Kazakh leader urges Iran pipeline route. I'm just throwing this out to you to show you that this is what's on their mind. It's constantly on their mind. Doesn't matter what country is around that region that has oil, they're always trying to negotiate where to run the pipeline and what are going to be their concerns. Security. That's right. That's what it's all about. So that's what the troops are there for. Mark my word. That's what the troops are there for. Whether in Iraq. Where was the first place that the troops, the U.S. soldiers in Iraq went to during the war? The oil installations. It's the first place. It's so blatant. They thought they could get away with being blatant.
Still are.
Well, and they did. But they may not forever. Which is, by the way, why I wrote that book, The People versus Bush, which is a whole other story. But in any event, this is just to show you growing military presence, and it's all about protecting pipelines, and all these white areas is where new military bases have been built. And you can see them, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Turkey, Pakistan, etc. So now we come to Afghanistan. Here's Turkmenistan next to the Caspian Sea. The pipeline is to run through Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. And as you will see, there's the word TAPI on it, T-A-P-I. Okay? So now, for me, I look at this, having been trained in pipeline politics, and I say, let's see the route of that pipeline. Okay. So it goes right through this particular bulge right here, which is where Afghanistan meets up with Pakistan. What do you think we're going to find?
Security.
Terrorists? What else? Military?
Base.
How about where are the troops stationed? Kandahar province, does that ring a bell? Now let's look at this. Remember that hump I showed you? This is Afghanistan. This is the hump. This is Pakistan. This is where the pipeline's running through. And I have read stories which say that that's where the troops are concentrated, right around where this pipeline is supposed to run through. And by the way, this is why there are also incursions into Pakistan, because they have to keep the security in Pakistan, too, if they want this thing to run through.
What was your interest in drugs?
Oh, yes, drugs. Actually, someone tacked that on. I hadn't planned to talk about it, but I'd be happy to talk about it. Undoubtedly, you have heard that the U.S. had initially backed not only the Taliban, but the Islamic insurgency. The CIA had backed them to weaken the Soviet Union, right, in the 1980s? You've all heard that, probably. Anyway, so the point is, what was funding those covert operations? Because these were covert. This was not something that Congress passed a bill and voted for. This was very covert. What funded it?
Drugs.
The heroin trade. This is just a continuation of what went on in Vietnam. I'm sure some of you may be familiar with Alfred McCoy's book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, in which the CIA funded, got engaged in the heroin trade among tribesmen, and they used the money to not only back up the people they wanted to use in helping them in the war, but also to just get illicit money to fund their operations. So this is not new. It's just a continuation of an old policy. We now know that you will hear that Karzai's brother is corrupt. Karzai's brother is a major opium dealer. It's something that the United States is not happy to highlight and rarely do. But that money goes to funding a lot of covert CIA operations in the area. That's the heroin connection. You know, the Taliban tried to wipe out the drugs, interestingly. And there was a time when the U.S. was closely allied with the Taliban. And as a matter of fact, do you know why the U.S. allied with the Taliban at one point? Does anyone have a clue why that might be? Well, the whole point was that the Taliban were more than willing to pacify the region so that the pipeline could run through it. And the Taliban, you even had members of the Taliban going down to Texas and negotiating with people in the Bush administration. This was all going to be a done deal. And then somehow, and I haven't got the conclusive word for why this happened, but in the summer of 2001, the whole relationship went sour. And part of it was apparently that the Taliban thought that they were going to get some of the gas being offshooted into Afghanistan to help build Afghanistan. And this was not part of the deal. The gas was to go to India and to go to Pakistan. You know, one of the things that I find very tragic is that to this day, of course, the U.S. government does not talk about this pipeline connection, because when you think about it, what are our soldiers there for? I mean, to support natural gas going to Pakistan and India? I mean, it isn't even helping the United States, ostensibly.
Well, I'm just curious. You know, we're talking about how the United States government is doing all of this, but at the same time, it's showing how with us being in these wars, it's bankrupting our country. The only ones who stand to profit really are the private industries. Meanwhile, Russia and China are building up their power and obviously are looking at this region as well. So it would seem to me that our interests are actually weakened now, even though we have bases.
Well, you're absolutely right. All of that is going on. Why? Because the great game continues. So the question is, how do you manage the great game? And I just watched last night a fascinating interview with Charlie Rose, with the Russian ambassador and a Chinese entrepreneur. And what I've learned is that the Russian-U.S. relations have been improved since Obama. I suspect one of those reasons is that Obama has a different bunch of people backing him than Bush and Cheney. And I talk about a little bit in my book, The People versus Bush. I have a chapter in there which says, what is this all about? I focus primarily on the illegal war in Iraq. If I can boil it down, it's as follows. The Bush-Cheney group were sort of a renegade group. I believe they were vying for the oil in Iraq. Well, we know that. And Afghanistan. But they represented the Texas independence. And there is a whole history of antagonism between the Southern Texas independent oil companies and the Eastern elites, namely the Rockefellers. You all know about the Rockefeller Republicans who are considered liberal and moderates a la Nelson Rockefeller. And by the way, I spent 18 years with my husband writing a book on Nelson Rockefeller and how he built an empire in Latin America, so I know of what I speak. Certainly about how the Rockefellers operate. So my running hypothesis, I still haven't had a chance to completely work this out, is as follows. You had this renegade group running our foreign policy during the Bush administration. Bush was powerful, but not as powerful as the Rockefellers. They were trying to get in. Why? Because the Seven Sisters, the oil majors, have throughout the 20th century always managed to get the major contracts. And the independents have always resented this. So here was a chance with Bush in power to make a run into Iraq and to ally themselves very closely with Israel to get a major stake. And ultimately, they got some in Kurdistan. There's an oil deal between Hunt Oil and the Kurdish provisional government. As far as I know, that's one of the few oil deals that they were able to conclude. If you talk today, you want to look today at who are doing the major contracts with the Iraq government, the central government in Baghdad, they're the majors again. Why? Obama is in power now. Obama has the major backing of the Rockefellers. I know this is a fact. It's written about in the book. One of Obama's major funders was Jay Rockefeller, who is the senator from West Virginia. And there's been an antagonism. Cheney and Rumsfeld succeeded in preventing Nelson Rockefeller from being vice president under Ford. Nelson Rockefeller never forgot about it. And so there's this rivalry that's been going on for the longest time. So what I would say is, you know, the Bushes are out of power. The Rockefeller people are in power. Obama was groomed for leadership under the Trilateral Commission, which is this major think tank type group. David Rockefeller funded it in 1973. The whole idea is sort of to make the world safe for large corporations without wars. You know, they're always on the lookout for rising stars, people who they think is going to usher us into the new era. Kissinger was thrilled that Obama was going to be our next president. And he talked about what this was going to mean for the New World Order. But I would also say that the Rockefellers are far more sophisticated in their foreign policy than these cowboys, if you like, from Texas and California, new wealth versus old wealth, because they've had a century to perfect rule. And I don't think that the Rockefeller people would ever go into the Middle East with a sledgehammer. Because, you know, my father was part of that whole orbit. They had to understand the local sensitivities, and they knew that my father himself made a warning in 1943. He said, God help us if we ever send troops into the Middle East. And where was my father trained before he said that? At AUB, American University, Beirut, an ecumenical university that prides itself on being sensitive to local cultural differences. So there's a whole different approach. So now you got Obama being less ideological with the Russians, and the Russians are saying the tensions have eased. So we'll see. Nonetheless, many people are upset that things haven't changed the way we had thought they would with Obama coming into power, which is a whole other subject you may want to ask me about. But
tie that into that whole theory that was being talked about in, was it the 70s or 80s, the cowboys and the...
The Yankee and Cowboy War, Oglesby's book. Yeah, it's just simply that. It's actually... All right, my husband and I wrote a book called Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller and Evangelism in the Age of Oil. It's 1,000 pages long. It took us 18 years. One of the things we learned was that that antagonism goes as far back as the early 1900s, when the powerful Rockefeller oil interests started diversifying into like agribusiness, and they were also taking over like fundamentalist schools and secularizing them, and so they were moving in on rural culture, and rural culture hated them for it. And it was also because they had a more mechanized, advanced manufacturing base. They were able to compete and beat out the smaller farmers, the smaller industries. And so you had this resentment based in the South. And then there were certain political people who fed on the resentment. One of them was an upstart in the Republican Party who goes by the name of Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was very close to the Bushes. And so you have this anger at the Eastern elites. Another person who was used to actually advance the Bush rise towards the White House came from California, Richard Nixon. That's all documented in Baker's book. And so you know how Richard Nixon hated those pinstripe elitists from, yeah, they used that. And one of the things about Nixon that's so fascinating is he was torn. He got into that White House, and he knew that it was because of the Southern, you know, the cowboys or whatever, that he was there, right? But he had to deal with the powers that be in the East. And you can see that struggle that he goes through. I'll just throw out one thing that I found very fascinating is that... Once Nixon came into office, he wanted to get the lowdown. He thought because he was president, he could order anything, including the lowdown on the Kennedy assassination. He wanted all of the government documents on the Kennedy assassination, and he was shocked to find out that the military would not give it to him, or the CIA, which gives you an idea of that, you know, they run for presidency, they think they're going to be very powerful, then they get into office and they realize that they're not the most powerful people in the world. Yes.
Back to your father for a minute. You suggested that the wrong reasons were given for his death, so, mm-hmm. but you didn't say anything about, you know, there was a plane crash, but you didn't say anything about what caused the plane crash.
Okay.
And you also said that he initially was supposed to spy on the Germans, and then he was supposed to help make the Saudi Arabia pipeline area, make that area safe for the pipeline developers. Did he know that? How did that come about? Did they all of a sudden say, okay, the war's over, now I want you to... I mean, what does that mean? That's pretty vague. Make the area safe.
Well, he was told, and he wrote in one of his first reports home, that, quote-unquote, this is going to be a real... free for all. So he had been told his job was to protect American interests at all costs. He knew that. And as a matter of fact, I got a document from the CIA where they didn't redact a line. Every once in a while that happens, you know, they black out all this part and then you find this jewel that somehow that they forgot or they just goofed. And there it was, and it said that Saudi Arabia has very important oil resources, and that we must protect it at all costs. At all costs.
But what does that mean?
It means that...
Protect it without having a force. But
right.
Spies don't... That's not usually what a spy does.
Well, <Is it? laughs> well, his job was counterintelligence, which is the highest level of espionage. Counterintelligence means that his job is to spy on the other spies and to prevent them from penetrating U.S. intelligence. All right?
So he has to penetrate their intelligence.
That's right. His job is to penetrate their intelligence and to shield our intelligence. By the way, guess who his exact counterpart was at the time of his death This is only for people who are into spy stories. But there was somebody very famous, probably the most famous spy in history, at least in the 20th century, who was his exact counterpart in the British counterintelligence. Anybody know that name? Kim Philby? Kim Philby was counterintelligence for the British, and of course he was a double agent for the Russians. And one of the things I found out is that he was stationed in Turkey and had just made a visit to Saudi Arabia a few weeks before my father's last fateful trip to Saudi Arabia. And so I've done a lot of research into what Kim Philby was up to. But in one sense, I mean, he was working a double game for the British and for the Russians. Meanwhile, both of them were against my father. They were spying on my father, and my father was spying on them.
Back to your comment about the Russians. What was your point that you were making?
A comment about the Russians, sorry?
And Obama, that he's been president, that okay. Relations with the Russians
have eased.
Had improved, and I didn't get where you were
okay.
Going with that.
All right.
And how that ties into the oil people.
All right. The Russians, they all know what the game is. The fact of the matter is, under Bush, everything was ideologically driven. So that the Bush people were more virulently anti-communist than Obama and his foreign policy group. And so, therefore, like I saw the Russian foreign minister was talking, and he was just saying, you know, we have to cooperate more in the region. I mean, whether they will or not, that could be just rhetoric. But what the foreign minister said last night on a fascinating interview on Rose's show was that that relations are better, there's less tension, even though we know, as he said, economics drives everything. That's what the Russians said. So we know that we're competing against each other, but we also are worried about having a degree of stability, because the one thing that all major corporations want, they don't want war. They really don't want it. They want stability.
Get back to the great game, as you call it, in this particular context. It looks to a lot of observers now, and you're beginning to see this in print, that the war in Afghanistan is essentially lost, that the U.S. is not going to be able to get control there. They're not mm-hmm. going to be able to create security there for U.S. interests. And so what becomes of the pipeline project? What stage is it at? They haven't actually started any construction.
I think they have started construction, but I think it's halted because of the war.
What's your
well, that's the problem.
The outlook of all this?
That's the problem. I think, you know, many people are saying, "What are we doing there?" How often have you seen war movies where you see the poor soldiers? You know, they've been at it for some time, and they're turning to each other and they're saying, "Why are we here? Why are we fighting?" It's that story all over again. I think the reason we're staying in is because there's this hope that somehow they're going to stabilize the region. But so far, they have not succeeded. I mean, they thought they had it in the bag with the Taliban. And there's this great quote in one of these documents where they said that the ambassador sort of let it slip that when the Taliban took over Kabul, this was back in 1994, I believe, when they were very strong. There was like a sigh of relief because we had our allies in place. So now who are they going to use as their allies? The problem is that the war has just antagonized the local population. The drone killings have antagonized the local population. So it's going woefully bad. And, of course, we all know that Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. Part of it has to do with the geography. Part of it has to do with all these different ethnicities that are easily stirred up. One thing I learned from looking at my father's papers is that when you've got people of different ethnic groups and they're fighting each other, you know, scratch the surface a little bit and you'll find a foreign power there turning one group against the other group. So here we got a major battleground of the great game. And who's stirring things up to make it difficult for the Americans? I don't know, because I don't have access to the intelligence reports. But I would wager that that's going on. It could be even Russians and Chinese, for all we know.